guys, welcome back to another episode of Textory. If you don't know what Textory is, it's a podcast where we pick a historical text, we dissect it, we go crazy, and we react to it. I mean, a lot of these texts are surprisingly modern, I would say. So that's what we're all about. And then before we get into it, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/textory. So if you enjoy the podcast and you want to keep it running, please head there and check out the things I have to offer. Anyway, today we are time traveling to the second half of the 18th century, and we are going straight into Versailles. So we are visiting France. I must admit, I've never been to Versailles, which is actually shocking. I've been to Paris probably 3 times. 2 of these times, it was only a couple of days and I didn't really have a time for like a whole day trip. One of those times I was offered like either we do Versailles today or we do another thing that I really wanted to do. And I picked another thing and I have been sort of regretting it ever since. Not regretting, but I really want to see it one day, but it's just never really happened. So I'm actually really excited to see it one day and experience the, I'm assuming, vastness of it, because it does look huge. And also I'm really interested in that cottagecore village that Marie Antoinette had. I don't know like how much of it you can actually see nowadays. I have no idea. If you've ever been to Versailles, let me know, because like I'm actually interested. But all that aside, today we are talking about a woman that was a member of the court around that time, and her name was Madame Campan. Is that how you pronounce it in French? I actually have no idea. Let me just check real quick. Okay, I'm just gonna stick with Madame Campan. So Madame Campan was an interesting figure in that era and in French history in general, because not only did she make a career at Louis the 15th court, she then went on to serve Marie Antoinette. And she then survived the revolution, which was a little bit after her, but also she wasn't really an aristocrat, so she was less threatened by it. Ended up completely broke because of the revolution. She lost most of her stuff. Then she started a career in teaching. From what I understand, she started her own school. And then she ended up becoming Napoleon's friend and, let's say, a champion for female education. So she basically survived 3 consecutive political systems, which I think is a testament to her intelligence and her adaptation skills. So she was not born rich, but her father was quite influential because he was the highest ranking official in the Foreign Office. And that's sort of why they had good connections, as you would call it back then. They knew the right people. But on top of that, she was very smart. She was good at languages. In fact, she was so good that she was getting sort of like a reputation for her academic accomplishments, which, mind you, for a woman in mid-18th century, and a woman that was not even rich or coming from an aristocratic background or a royal, I would say it's quite an unusual thing to be recognized for. So because she was like the designated gifted child in the French high society, she ended up being employed as a reader to king's daughters at the age of 15. I'm trying to grasp what being a reader involved. From my understanding, she was basically their tutor at the age of 15, if I remember correctly. And she was sort of a teacher to them. And then mere 2 years later, so she was what, 17, she was appointed as Marie Antoinette's chambermaid. Now, you may think, okay, so she probably helped her dress and undress because clothing was really complex at the time. Wrong. One thing you have to remember is that the French court at the time was incredibly structural and incredibly ceremonial. Everyone had a role to play in the royal spectacle. Everyone had their own duty that they had to follow. There was like literal hundreds of people involved in the lives of the royals, and everything was a spectacle. So the dressing and undressing itself, I mean, it was a whole ceremony, but that was the duty of Dame Dator. Whereas Femme de Chambre, oh my God, where did that French art come from. But they were basically in charge of the wardrobe and preparing everything. So that's what Madame Campan did. She was preparing the clothes, she was preparing the cosmetics, everything had to be ready for the ceremonies. And that was not just her job, it involved a couple of femmes de chambre. And in charge of all the femmes de chambre was premier femme de chambre. So she was one of the only women in court that had keys to all queen's apartments, all of the rooms, and she basically had 24/7 access to the queen. And that's who Madame Campan ended up being. She was like the supervisor of the other femmes de chambre, so the other women responsible for the wardrobe preparations. At some point, there were four sort of supervisors leading the regular chambermaids. And one of those four supervisors was Madame Campan. And it stayed this way until revolution came to Versailles' door, turned everything upside down and inside out, and that whole system, that whole hierarchy did not exist any longer. So today we're reading Madame Campan's memoirs. They were first published in 1823, so a year after her death. And I have to say, they were not quite what they sound like. So when I first heard about this book, I was like, oh my God, she's gonna spill the tea. But you have to remember that those people back then were very committed to the royals. If you spend your whole life serving them, the majority of those people would not just flip a switch during the revolution and go like, yeah, I actually hated that. Because they went through their lives being fed the idea that the royals are like superhumans that you are entitled to spend time and energy on. So obviously they were not going to be like, yeah, she kind of sucked anyway. So Madame Campan is very careful about what she writes. She actually delves into politics a lot. She explains a lot of like historical events. And also I have to say, again, she's very vague. And you can tell she 100% idealizes and idolizes Marie Antoinette and the whole royal family. Even just the way she phrases her memories, it sounds like there was this ethereal presence in Versailles that she got to witness. It's never, yeah, she was my friend, we were hanging out. It's more like the grace of her presence was bestowed upon me. I think it's honestly common within people that have worked with famous historical figures that they sort of put those figures on pedestals for the rest of their lives. That's the impression I get when I'm reading memoirs or letters or diaries of people that were in presence of famous historical people. And also, as I mentioned, she spent most of her life in a very structured system, or in systems rather, where you had to know your place, you had to remember who's more important than who. There was a whole set of rules that she had to follow and obey at all times. So you genuinely believed that you were below some people and above other people. It was very, very clear to you. She starts off with describing her life at Versailles at the times of Louis XV. I have put together all that concerned the domestic life of an unfortunate princess, whose reputation is not yet cleared of the stains it received from the attacks of calumny, and who justly merited a different lot in life, a different place in the opinion of mankind after her fall. These memoirs, which were finished 10 years ago, have met with the approbation of some persons, and my son may, perhaps, think proper to print them after my decease. The editor of the book mentions that she did not know that her son was actually going to pass away before her, which is a little crazy. I was 15 years of age when I was appointed reader to Madame's. I will begin by describing the court at that period. Maria Leczinska was just dead. Okay, let's stop here. Let's stop right here. So, as you may know, the king had a Polish wife whose name was, hear me out, Maria Leszczyńska. And for whatever reason, I think the only reason is that Polish names are generally considered too complicated to pronounce. Her last name was simplified during the course of history to Maria Leczinska, which is like, it's not even a word, it's not even a name. from a Polish perspective, it makes absolutely no sense. So I think I've even seen it being stylized as Maria Leczyński, which, like, she is a woman. She is a Polish woman. Polish women's names end with an A. It's complicated. Basically, it's complicated. If it ends with a ska, like my name, then it should be an A. If it's a different name, like Iga Świątek, then it doesn't have to be an A. It's complicated. Don't ask me why. I don't know why, but just my disclaimer is that whenever I see Maria Leczyńska, I get similarly angry to when I see Marie Curie instead of Maria Skłodowska-Curie. So keep that in mind. The death of the Dauphin had preceded hers by 3 years. Dauphin was her and the king's son and the father of Louis XVI. The Jesuits were suppressed and piety was to be found at court only in the apartments of Madame. Etiquette still existed at court with all the forms it had acquired under Louis XIV. Dignity alone was wanting. As to gaiety, there was none. Versailles was not the place at which to seek for assemblies where French spirit and grace were displayed. The focus of wit and intelligence was Paris. I have to admit, when I was younger, I used to think that Versailles was in Paris because so many of the royal residencies are in the middle of big cities, but it's quite far actually, isn't it? And it used to be a completely separate town. The king thought of nothing but the pleasures of the chase. It might have been imagined that the courtiers indulged themselves in making epigrams by hearing them say seriously, on those days when the king did not hunt, "The king does nothing today." The arrangement beforehand of his movements was also a matter of great importance with Louis XV. On the first day of the year, he noted down in his almanac the days of departure from Compiègne, Fontainebleau, Choisy, etc. The weightiest matters, the most serious events, never deranged this distribution of his time. Since the death of the Marquise de Pompadour, the king had no titled mistress. He contented himself with his seraglio in the Parc aux Cerfs. The king delighted to manage the most disgraceful points of his private expenses himself. He one day sold to a head clerk in the War Department a house in which one of his mistresses had lodged. The contract ran in the name of Louis de Bourbon, so his sort of, well, not his king name, but his family name. And the purchaser himself took in a bag the price of the house in gold to the king in his private closet. I've seen elsewhere that it is not entirely true, but she suggests that the king managed his own affairs himself. Louis XV saw very little of his family. He came every morning by a private staircase into the apartment of Madame Adelaide, so that was one of his daughters that Madame Campan was teaching. He often brought and drank there coffee that he had made himself. Madame Adelaide pulled a bell which apprised Madame Victoire of the king's visit. Madame Victoire, on rising to go to her sister's apartment, rang for Madame Sophie, who in turn rang for Madame Louise. The apartments of Madame's were of very large dimensions. Madame Louise occupied the farthest room. This latter lady was deformed and very short. The poor princess used to run with all her might to join the daily meeting, but having a number of rooms to cross, she frequently, in spite of her haste, had only just time to embrace her father before he set out for the chase. This is gonna make me cry. Just imagine a disabled royal daughter trying to use up like the only 10 seconds of the time she has with her dad during the day, and she can't make it because she can't run so far. This is breaking my heart. But also, whenever something like that appears in those texts, I'm like, man, it sure was not a fun time to be a disabled person. The men of ambition who were laboring to overthrow the Duc de Choiseul strengthened themselves by their concentration at the house of the favorite and succeeded in their project. Duc de Choiseul was at the time the foreign minister of France, so it makes sense that she talks about him a lot because obviously her dad was involved with the foreign ministry. The bigots who never forgave that minister the suppression of the Jesuits and who had always been hostile to a treaty of alliance with Austria influenced the minds of Madame. So the daughters, basically. The Duc de la Vosges... Okay, no, actually, you know what? We're going to do it this way.
Duc de la Vauguillon.
Exactly this guy. The young defense governor infected them with the same prejudices. So she's saying the daughters were under the influence of the dauphin's governor, whose name you've just heard and I'm not going to repeat it. Such was the state of the public mind when the young Archduchess Marie Antoinette arrived at the court of Versailles, just at the moment when the party which brought her there was about to be overthrown. Marie Antoinette Joseph Jean de Lorraine, Archduchess of Austria, daughter of François de Lorraine and of Maria Theresa, was born on the 2nd of November 1755, the day of the earthquake at Lisbon. And this catastrophe, which appeared to stamp the era of her birth with a fatal mark, without forming a motive for superstitious fear with the princess, nevertheless made an impression upon her mind. I doubt it. Like, I don't think her mind was in any way impressed by what happened during her birth, but I'm assuming it must have been the people that kept repeating it to her when she was growing up. The Empress, so the Empress is her mother, obviously. It's the German Empress Maria Theresa. The Empress was too much taken up with high political interests to have it in her power to devote herself to maternal attentions. The celebrated Van Swieten, her physician, went daily to visit the young imperial family and afterwards to Maria Theresa and gave the most minute details respecting the health of the archdukes and archduchesses, whom she herself sometimes did not see for 8 or 10 days at a time. That is really sad. It's almost just as sad as Louis XV barely ever seeing his daughters as well. Or all his children, because I think he had like 2 sons. Louis XV was enchanted with the young Dauphiness. All his conversation was about her graces, her vivacity, and the aptness of her repartees. She was yet more successful with the royal family when they beheld her shorn of the splendor of the diamonds with which she had been adorned during the first days of her marriage. When clothed in a light dress of gauze or taffeta, she was compared to the Venice de' Medici and the Atalanta of the Marly Gardens. Poets sang her charms, painters attempted to copy her features. One artist's fancy led him to place the portrait of Marie Antoinette in the heart of a full-blown rose. His ingenious idea was rewarded by Louis XV. I have to say, this is one of those examples where she's like clearly idolizing her, because when you read like reports from the era, Marie Antoinette was not considered specifically like very beautiful by the beauty standards at the time. She was considered charming. But she had features that were back then associated with the Habsburg family. Those were not beauty standards at the time. She also has quite a prominent nose in most of the portraits, so we can assume that it was a feature that drew attention of the people around her. So this has definitely to do with her position and her power. The way they were treating her, like she was literally, like she said, she was compared to Venus. The Dauphiness continually gave proofs of both sense and feeling. Sometimes she even suffered herself to be carried away by those transports of compassionate kindness, which are not to be controlled by the customs which rank establishes. I did not understand a single word in that whole sentence. She's carried away by transport of compassionate kindness. Okay, so she was kind, I guess that's what she's trying to say. In consequence of the fire in the Place Louis XV, which occurred at the time of the nuptial entertainments, the Dauphin and Dauphiness sent their whole income for the year to the relief of the unfortunate families who lost their relatives on that disastrous day. Okay, so this was a horrific incident, actually. So in 1770, as they were sort of celebrating their marriage, there was a fireworks display in Paris in Place Louis... I'm not going to attempt... whatever, like Louis the 15th. It's actually now Place de la Concorde. And structures that were used for the fireworks, they caught fire and there was a panic and there was a stampede, basically. So people were trying to escape. The street was narrow. And oh my God, over 100 people died, according to some estimates, which is a crazy amount of losses from a single event like this. And what she's saying is that Marie Antoinette was really shaken by this. This was one of those ostentatious acts of generosity, which are dictated by the policy of princes, at least as much as by their compassion. But the grief of Marie Antoinette was profound and lasted several days. Nothing could console her for the loss of so many innocent victims. She spoke of it weeping to her ladies, one of whom, thinking no doubt to divert her mind, told her that a great number of thieves had been found among the bodies, and that their pockets were filled with watches and other valuables. They have at least been well punished, added the person who related these particulars. Oh no, no, madame, replied the Dauphiness, they died by the side of honest people. So this is what I meant when I was saying that she's sort of seeing Marie Antoinette through those like rose-colored glasses of a person that served her. Because, I mean, obviously it's nice that they gave money for the victims, but also, I mean, why wouldn't they? People died because they were trying to watch their wedding. And she's like, this was an ostentatious act of generosity. So she blows everything out of proportion a little bit. So she then mentions that Marie Antoinette was very much into theater, which we know she loved hosting little plays, little shows. She loved performing as well. A kind of proscenium, which could be taken down and shut up in a closet, formed the whole theater. The Comte de Provence always knew his part with imperturbable accuracy. The Comte d'Artois knew his tolerably well and recited elegantly. The princesses acted badly. The Dauphiness acquitted herself in some characters with discrimination and feeling. The chief pleasure of this amusement consisted in all the costumes being elegant and accurate. The Dauphin entered into the spirit of these diversions and laughed heartily at the comic characters as they came on the scene. From these amusements may be dated his discontinuance of the timid manner of his youth and his taking pleasure in the society of the Dauphiness. So as we know, the beginning of the marriage was quite rocky, like they were not getting along great, and it was mostly from his side there was this coldness or shyness, and he just would not cooperate whatsoever. He would not spend time with her. And she's saying, I mean, Madame Campan is saying that this was the moment where he actually genuinely started enjoying spending time with her, and that was because of the plays. Also, I can relate to the main attraction of the theater plays being the beautiful and accurate costumes. Like, Marie Antoinette was the OG costumer. Marie Antoinette, RIP, would have loved costume reviews and rants. It was not till a long time afterwards that I learned these particulars. Monsieur Campan having kept the secret. So that's her father-in-law. That's her husband's dad. But an unforeseen event had well nigh exposed the whole mystery. One day the queen desired Monsieur Campan to go down into her closet to fetch something that she had forgotten. He was dressed for the character of Crispin and was rouged. A private staircase led direct to the entresol through the dressing room. Monsieur Campan fancied he heard some noise and remained still behind the door, which was shut. A servant belonging to the wardrobe, who was in fact on the staircase, had also heard some noise, and either from fear or curiosity, he suddenly opened the door. The figure of Crispin frightened him so that he fell down backwards, shouting with his might, "Help! Help!" My father-in-law raised him up, made him recognize his voice, and laid upon him an injunction of silence as to what he had seen. He felt himself, however, bound to inform the Dauphiness of what had happened, and she was afraid that a similar occurrence might betray their amusements. They were therefore discontinued. So from my understanding, these surf plays were secret. They didn't want anyone to know about them, which I don't think is what happened at Petit Trianon, where she was staging these for her friends. I think it's a different occurrence, because this is like early on when she was still not queen yet. But also interesting to note that the man was rouged, as if it was something unusual. So I think it also gives us an idea that A, either stage makeup was so different from daily makeup, or B, they did not use as many makeup on a daily basis, especially men, as we sometimes tend to think. Or maybe it was just seen as controversial for older men. While Louis XV reigned, the enemies of Marie Antoinette made no attempt to change public opinion with regard to her. She was always popular with the French people in general, and particularly with the inhabitants of Paris, who went on every opportunity to Versailles, the majority of them attracted solely by the pleasure of seeing her. About the beginning of May 1774, Louis XV, the strength of whose constitution had promised a long enough life, was attacked by confluent smallpox of the worst kind. Madame, at this juncture, inspired the Dauphiness with a feeling of respect and attachment, of which she gave them repeated proofs when she ascended the throne. In fact, nothing was more admirable nor more affecting than the courage with which they braved that most horrible disease. The air of the palace was infected. More than 50 persons took the smallpox, in consequence of having merely loitered in the galleries of Versailles, and 10 died of it. That's actually crazy. I mean, we are still so shocked by how vicious COVID was. Imagine having multiple diseases just roaming around in society that could just one day end up at your household and people would just start dying, start dropping dead. I think it's difficult to comprehend the threat that people dealt with every day. Like, every day they woke up and they were like, whoa, made it. Because there were just so many things that could take you out. At the period of his grandfather's death, Louis XVI began to be exceedingly attached to the queen. The first period of so deep a mourning, not admitting of indulgence in the diversion of hunting, he proposed to her walks in the gardens of Choisy. They went out like husband and wife, the young king giving his arm to the queen and accompanied by a very small suit. The influence of this example had such an effect upon the courtiers that the next day, several couples, who had long and for good reasons been disunited, were seen walking upon the terrace with the same apparent conjugal intimacy. Thus they spent whole hours braving the intolerable wearisomeness of their protracted tête-à-tête. Out of mere obsequious imitation, I genuinely don't know how to read most of these words, but it's just so funny that the king was genuinely going through mourning, like he just lost a grandfather, and he was like, you know what? You know what would make me feel really good? If we just went on a simple walk. And then all of the courtiers are like, shit, we have to do the same now. I know I hate you and we haven't spoken for 2 years, but like, could you walk the terrace with me? If you're wondering where any descriptions of her wardrobe are, now is the time that she finally lifts a cover on what the whole dressing ceremony looked like. The queen's toilet was a masterpiece of etiquette. Everything was done in a prescribed form. Both the dame d'honneur and the dame d'atour usually attended and officiated, assisted by the first femme de chambre and two ordinary women. The dame d'atour put on the petticoat and handed the gown to the queen. The dame d'honneur poured out the water for her hands and put on her linen. When a princess of the royal family happened to be present while the queen was dressing, the dame d'honneur yielded to her the latter act of office, but still did not yield it directly to the princesses of the blood. In such a case, the dame d'honneur was accustomed to present the linen to the first femme de chambre, who in her turn handed it to the princess of the blood. This is so unnecessarily complicated. Each of these ladies observed these rules scrupulously as affecting her rights. One winter's day it happened that the queen, who was entirely undressed, was just going to put on her shift. I held it ready and folded for her. The dame d'honneur came in, slipped off her gloves and took it. A scratching was heard at the door. It was opened and in came the Duchess d'Orléans. Her gloves were taken off and she came forward to take the garment. But as it would have been wrong in the dame d'honneur to hand it to her, she gave it to me and I handed it to the princess. Oh my god, can you imagine? You're just standing there naked, it's freezing cold, and they're like debating who should hand the shift to whom first, so it's like proper and it follows the etiquette. I would have screamed. More scratching. It was Madame la Comtesse de Provence. The Duchess d'Orléans handed her the linen. All this while the queen kept her arms crossed upon her bosom and appeared to feel cold. Madame observed her uncomfortable situation and, merely laying down her handkerchief without taking off her gloves, she put on the linen and in doing so knocked the queen's cap off. The queen laughed to conceal her impatience, but not until she had muttered several times, "How disagreeable, how tiresome." I mean, I feel you, girl. If that was what my mornings looked like, I don't even know what I would do. I would probably just abdicate. Now, this is interesting because we tend to imagine that people in the past owned like a gazillion of garments. And most of the time when you look at wardrobe lists of clothes that people wore, it's not that many clothes. And it's not that many, even if we were super rich. So here's what she says about this. For the winter, the queen had generally 12 full dresses, 12 undresses called fancy dresses, and 12 rich hoop petticoats for the card and supper parties in the smaller apartments. Okay, let's unpack this. 12 full dresses, so full, I'm assuming, is like ceremonial. 12 undresses called fancy dresses, so that would probably be like costumes, dresses for fancy balls, I'm actually not sure, and then 12 rich hoop petticoats. So at first I would be like, okay, hoop petticoat was probably just an undergarment, but the fact that she says rich and the fact that there's 12 of them, I'm assuming she's referring to the whole gown, which would make a lot more sense. She had as many for the summer. Those for the spring served likewise for the autumn. All these dresses were discarded at the end of each season, unless indeed she retained some that she particularly liked. I am not speaking of muslin or cambric gowns, or others of the same kind. They were lately introduced, but such as these were not renewed at each returning season. They were kept several years. The chief women were charged with the care and examination of the diamonds. This important duty was formerly confided to the tirewoman, but for many years had been included in the business of the first femme de chambre. Okay, new gowns every season, that was probably the part of it being rich, was like, you didn't own that many gowns, like in modern standards, because compared to other women at the era, that was probably still excessive, but she only had 12 gowns. Okay, no, that's like, what, 24? Okay, she had like dozens of dresses, but it's still like not hundreds of dresses as we could imagine sometimes. And then the only thing that shows that she was actually insanely rich was the fact that they were discarded every season. I find it interesting that she didn't discard of the muslin and cambric gowns. They were just like kept, even though you would imagine that these fabrics were a lot more flimsy and prone to breaking than, let's say, silk brocade. All who were acquainted with the queen's private qualities knew that she equally deserved attachment and esteem. Kind and patient to excess in her relations with her household, she indulgently considered all around her and interested herself in their fortunes and in their pleasures. This is like very sweet to be writing this about a person that you know has passed away in horrific circumstances, but also I cannot help but think that Madame Campan sort of considered her like a saint. So there is not a single thing here that she mentions that she dislikes. She's just like, yeah, she was perfect. Which seems very subjective, if you ask me. Okay, now they describe giving birth, which it just sounds like hell. It's not even just the birthing process, because she doesn't speak about that, but just listen to this. During the alarm for the life of the queen, regret at not possessing an heir to the throne was not even thought of. The king himself was wholly occupied with the care of preserving an adored wife. The young princess was presented to her mother, so she gave birth to a girl. "Poor little one," said the queen. "You are not wished for, but you are not on that account less dear to me. A son would have been rather the property of the state. You shall be mine. You shall have my undivided care, shall share all my happiness, and console me in all my troubles." The king dispatched a courier to Paris and wrote letters himself to Vienna, by the queen's bedside. And part of the rejoicings ordered took place in the capital. A great number of attendants watched near the queen during the first night of her confinement. This is the hellish part I was talking about. We all know nowadays how intimate and private postpartum is to those that have just given birth. Now add dozens of people watching you to the mix, and that's recipe for hell, in my personal opinion. I've never given birth, but this is what I imagine hell looks like. This custom distressed her. Oh, I wonder why. She knew how to feel for others and ordered large armchairs for her women, the backs of which were capable of being let down by springs, and which served perfectly well instead of beds. So this, I have to say, speaks to her character. Like, she was literally trying to recover back then, completely unmedicated and probably unable to receive any sort of care in the trenches of postpartum. And she still cared about women that were watching her as part of the ceremony, as part of the custom, being uncomfortable. Now, the last story is quite interesting because it shows you that she indeed had to deal with like a lot of vileness, is that even a word? A lot of ill will from other people at the time, even though she herself had little control over most things. But I mean, just tell me what you think about this. A few days after the queen's recovery from her confinement, the cure of the Magdalene de la City at Paris wrote to Monsieur Campan and requested a private interview with him. It was to desire he would deliver into the hands of the queen a little box containing her wedding ring, with this note written by the cure: "I have received under the seal of confession the ring which I sent to your majesty, with an avowal that it was stolen from you in 1771 in order to be used in sorceries to prevent you having any children." On seeing her ring again, the queen said that she had in fact lost it about 7 years before while washing her hands, and that she had resolved to use no endeavor to discover the superstitious woman who had done her the injury. What I think is the craziest part is not even that someone was trying to hex her so that she would be infertile, but the fact that it must have been someone from her closest surroundings. It must have been someone that had access to the area where she washed her hands. It must have been someone that was either her friend or a servant or just someone from her like nearest surroundings wishing her ill. Because even if they did not try and do the sorcery themselves, they still possibly sold it to someone that had bad intentions. And that's, I think, really sad. And genuinely, I think it kind of mirrors what celebrities have to go through nowadays. Oh, I know, oh, celebrities have such hard lives, but I think it must suck to know that everyone near to you, everyone dear to you, can potentially wish you ill and ruin your life by, let's say, selling someone a story about you, taking a picture of you when you don't want it. It must be so difficult to trust people when you're famous. I don't know. I don't know. I personally think it must be horrifically lonely. And I think that's the case with Marie Antoinette as well, was that she was just very lonely, which always gets me. I mean, it's always sad, regardless of who she was as a person, regardless what she represented. So that's the glimpse into the court life of Versailles. I have to say, when I was a teenager, I may or may not have romanticized a little bit. Like all the stories you read about royals and royal families. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't want to be a victim of the revolution. But at the same time, you're like, wow, they truly had everything. They had money. They had beautiful residences. They had beautiful gardens. They had beautiful dresses. But then when you realize that they did not belong to themselves, they belonged to the state, not even dressing up in the morning was something they had control of, it kind of brings a whole new perspective to who they were and what their purpose was. And I think that's actually similar with royal families nowadays. Like, I don't think they're free. I mean, there is a reason why Harry and Meghan moved out. I don't think they belong to themselves. So I think it's still a case of, even with all the money they have, they still don't have the freedom. So in case you feel bad about not having the money that the royals have, they're not really free either, I think, personally. I mean, that's the conclusion I came to today. So let me know what you think. Let me know if you've been to Versailles and if you can really feel Marie Antoinette's spirit in there or if it's completely gone. I'd love to know that. And hopefully one day I'll visit. So for now, head to patreon.com/textory to check out my Patreon posts, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye!